The North Star. Humans have looked to it for guidance for millennia. It goes by many names. In Cree, it's Skiweyatin.
The star Polaris, the North Star, one of the terms we have for it is called Kiweyatin. Kiweyatin from the root word kiwe, which means home. And there's varying perspectives of what that means. One, of course, is that it's the only star that doesn't move in the night sky. It stays stationary in the northerly direction. And that signifies where north is. And once you find where north is, you can pretty much find any other direction. And the other thing is, being that it's the only star that doesn't move in the northern hemisphere sky, it's called Egagatset, the standing still star. And it's a place where, of course, where north is, but it's also, they say, when we finish our visit at this place, to Otaeski, that our energy leaves, and that's the guiding star that takes us back to that sky and to Pagungisik, the hole in the sky.
Wilford Buck is a star knowledge keeper. He's part of a growing number of Indigenous researchers, educators, and astronauts exploring where no Indigeni has gone before. Space. Tanse Anin Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, it's Captain Deerchild, because we have a show that is truly out of this world. Wilford Buck is on a mission to restore our knowledge of the universe.
Every star had a connection. Every star had a constellation. Every star had a name. Every star had a ceremony. Every star had a song. Every star had a teaching.
Jennifer Howes reveals the night skies to young people as a way to reveal their connection to the stars.
They were just blown away by seeing the arc of the Milky Way in the sky.
And what does our tiny blue planet look like from orbit? Find out from Nicole Mann, the first Indigenous woman in space. These are the voyages of the starship Unreserved.
SpaceX reports go. Crew reports go. 30 seconds until liftoff.
She's been a Marine, a fighter pilot, an engineer, and now an astronaut.
T-minus 15.
Nicole Mann is a member of the Wolaiki of the Round Valley Indian Tribes.
10.
And this past October, she rocketed into orbit 20 years after Chickasaw astronaut John Harrington became the first Indigenous person to go to space. Nicole spent 157 days on the International Space Station doing research and experiments to prepare for explorations to the moon and to Mars. Nicole, welcome back to Earth and to Unreserved.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back on our planet.
I have to say that as a lifelong Star Trek nerd, Trekkie, this is like a huge privilege and an honor to speak with you today. You might be able to see I'm actually wearing my TNG space badge.
I noticed. It's looking very good.
Boop, boop. In honor of you.
Thank you.
So take us to your floating laboratory. You spent 5 months there. Describe that, well, space for us.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. You know, I thought about it so much before going to space. You know, what was it going to be like? I set all these expectations, and all those expectations were absolutely exceeded. It was just incredible. Living and working on board the International Space Station, not only are we doing some incredible science on board and maintenance upgrades to the space station, but it is so much fun just floating around in space. It feels like if you've ever had a dream when you were a kid that you were flying or floating, it feels just like that. It really does.
I can't even imagine. And as you said, your team conducted hundreds of experiments. Can you walk us through a couple of the kinds of experiments you did?
Absolutely. There's so many different experiments. A couple of my favorites. One is the biofabrication facility, or BFF. And this is where we are literally 3D printing human cells in space. And it sounds like a Star Trek type situation, right? But this is the reality now. It's because we're in microgravity, this laboratory, we can print the cells and they will grow and their structure will be more accurate than they would if you were printing them on Earth because of the gradient of gravity, because you have to have a structure that will interfere with the cell growth, because you have thermal gradients. You don't have any of this in space. And the concept is in the future, perhaps we can print a patch for your heart. So if you had a heart attack, you know, that muscle will not heal completely. And so we could patch the heart, or we could at some point maybe print 3D organs and fly those back to Earth where they could be transplanted. So there's that side of it. There's also a lot of robotics. We have these little flying robots called astrobees, and the little astrobees fly off each other with sensors. And the concept is that that can help astronauts in some of their daily activities. And that's future development for when we go to the moon and eventually Mars. It's going to be a combination of humans and robots really working together. And we've got to grow plants on board too. We grow dwarf tomatoes. It was incredible to smell the soil and to smell the plants, because the smell on station is a very sterile environment. It smells a little bit, you know, very like metallic, like a hospital, with some of the cleaning solutions that we use. And so it was really amazing to smell plant life and see these beautiful little red tomatoes.
That's very cool. I'm pretty sure I saw those episodes on Star Trek.
you might have. Yes, they're a reality now.
I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than that. How does doing those kinds of experiments in space help us to prepare for future exploration?
So some of this is technology development, and we're trying to develop you know, ways that we can sustain humans deeper into space. So perhaps that's when we have human presence, sustained presence on the lunar surface, or this journey to Mars, we could grow tomatoes. We also on board grew a yogurt and fermented and grew yeast to try to develop ways and where we could be self-sufficient in our food and our nutrients. And so not only if we can grow some of our food on these long missions, that will provide nutrients for our body, but there's also the psychological aspect of growing plants and kind of still being connected with your home planet while you're on a deep space exploration.
Wow, that's wonderful. Can you tell us what it was like living day to day on the International Space Station? Take me through what your typical day would be.
Your day, typically I woke up around 6 o'clock to just prepare for the day, eat breakfast, do your hygiene, look over your activities for the day. And at 7:30, typically that kind of kicks off the day. We have what's called a morning DPC with all of the mission controls throughout the world and all astronauts on board, just kind of, hey, review, this is the plan. Are there any changes to the plan? And then your time is literally 5-minute increments, boom, 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 you're scheduled. You have an hour for lunch in the middle. You have 2.5 hours of exercise, which includes time to change your clothes and to clean up after exercise. And that goes until 7:30 at night when you have the evening DPC again with all the mission control centers. So your days are so busy, but they're so fun and so engaging and so different every day. Maybe you'll be doing science in the morning, and then you're doing perhaps a video chat with some school children in the afternoon. And then you're fixing the toilet in the evening, you know, and you're doing another type of a science experiment later on. So it keeps you certainly engaged and excited every day. And I found that your body doesn't get tired. You know, if you have a long day at work, sometimes you get home, you're like, oh, I just need to lay down. I'm so tired. Your body doesn't get tired because you're literally floating around all day, but your mind will get tired. You can notice that your mind will fatigue if you have long days, day after day after day. And so it's important that you take care of your mind as well. And you take some of those mental breaks and you have a break on the weekend. You can just look out the window or maybe read a book or just spend some time to recharge yourself. So it's an important aspect of space flight that I didn't realize was going to be so significant. It's taking care of your mind as well.
Yeah, self-care is important wherever you are, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And I couldn't imagine reading a book in space. I would just want to stare out the window all the time.
I know. I didn't read a ton. Usually I looked out the window. That was my favorite pastime. Looking out the window and taking pictures, trying to capture that view.
Oh, man, that must be impossible to capture something like that.
It is. Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, photographs and video just cannot do it justice.
Yeah. Did you have time for fun things? For example, I heard you did some space selfies.
I did say some space selfies on the spacewalk, especially on the second, the first, I did two spacewalks. On the first one, it was just so new. I was so focused on just getting everything done. I didn't really take a moment to just reflect and just pause. So I was really intentional about that on the second spacewalk specifically. I wanted to take more photos. And even if it was just for 30 seconds, I want to pause for 30 seconds and just look around. You know, I'm literally climbing outside the space station, holding on with one hand, floating over the planet. I wanted to just live in that moment. And so I was glad that I took a moment to do that.
This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. My guest today is Nicole Mann, the first Indigenous woman to go to space.
And here we come through. First one through the hatch is going to be Nicole Mann, commander of Dragon, and now the first Native American woman to live and stay aboard the International Space Station.
And as the first Native American woman in space, how does that feel knowing that you're up there in space looking down at the planet and you're like, did you think of that? What did you think about
that? I did. I really did think of that. And it was an interesting journey for me. When I became a Marine, I didn't want to be a female Marine. I just want to be a Marine, right? I don't want to be a Native American engineer or astronaut. I just want to be an engineer and an astronaut. But as you actually take time to kind of widen your perspective and think about the importance of that and the importance of us celebrating first, the importance of us communicating specifically with the younger generation and sharing our journey and sharing our mission, it's important that we highlight that. It's important that we reach out to the communities that maybe have never been exposed to spaceflight before. And so I realized on board how important that is. And I had some chances to talk to some kids, you know, on reservations, some kids that didn't realize we have an International Space Station and astronauts are living on board. And one of them happens to be a Native American. And maybe that will inspire a young child to think about, wait, wow, that maybe that's something that I can do. And they get excited about that.
Yeah. How do kids react when you say, you know, I'm Native American and I'm from the Wailaiki community and this was, you know, something that I was able to accomplish? How do those kids react to you?
Oh, it's just incredible. You see just this light in their eyes just pop out and you can just see the wonder in their eyes and the little wheels in their brain just start turning and thinking and they get this big smile. And they actually have some really incredible questions, not only about, you know, living and working in space, but what do I need to do to do that? How could I achieve those dreams? Is that something you think that I can do? And I think that's so important. Unfortunately, there are still a lot of Indigenous people, a lot of people throughout the world from all different backgrounds, in fact, that have limited opportunities, that still live in an area where there are barriers, where they're not exposed, you know, to a great education. They're not exposed to these opportunities. We need to continue to work to break down those barriers and provide a community and a support structure for these children so that they know that their goals can be achieved, that they can dream these amazing, lofty things, and then we can give them the support to actually then move forward and achieve those dreams.
Mm. And what do you say to them when, you know, a little Star Trek nerd looks up at you and says, Nicole, how can I be an astronaut?
You know, the first thing I tell them is to be engaged and study in school. It's okay if you don't know exactly what your path is going to be. I didn't know when I was a young kid that I wanted to be an astronaut. It wasn't until later in life I realized that was a possibility. So you don't have to have it all figured out. Follow your passions in life. And study hard in school and keep all those doors open, all those opportunities open. Because as you go through life, you will change. Your interests may change. You will grow and you will learn. But as long as you have that solid foundation and these opportunities are there, they're going to be there for the taking. And don't feel like you have to do it on your own. I didn't do it on my own. I have a huge community back home, a large extended family that I really rely on a lot to help me out through those hard times because As I'm sure you know, we all have, you will stumble along the way and you will run into challenges. Mm-hmm. And so reach back on those people, whether that be your family or your community or your tribe. It's important to surround yourself with people that are going to support you in achieving those dreams.
That's amazing. Do you know how amazing you are? Like, I'm just sitting here going, oh my God, this woman's amazing.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much.
One of the things that we found out as we were researching you, and I feel like this is really kind of special, is that you brought a dream catcher along with you that your mom had given you when you were young. Why was that one of the things that was so important for you to bring along?
That was really important for me because it was just a piece of home and a piece of my childhood, which is really a piece of me that I wanted to bring to space. And so, you know, the dream catcher has a lot of symbolism. And for me, particularly when I was young, I had a lot of nightmares and bad dreams. And I remember my mom giving me a dream catcher and explaining that the dreams will come in and the bad dreams will be caught into the web, but that the good dreams will come down the feathers and go in, you know, into your brain. And that was a type of visualization that really helped me when I was a child. And I think it's that type of visualization that still helps me to this day. And so the dream catcher now symbolizes you know, a lot of my childhood, the support that I had from my parents, from my community in everything that I did. And when I was struggling with something or when I had, you know, a bad day or I started to doubt myself, it was a constant reminder. It floated in my crew quarters and in my little room, a constant reminder of my family back on planet Earth and all the people, all the love and all the support. And it's really that love and support that helps make all these dreams come true. I couldn't have done it without that support structure. And it made me smile, you know, each evening before I went to bed.
Dream catchers in space, not a lot of them.
Not a lot of them.
When you're talking, you talk a lot about support and the support of your community, support of your family. How did they support you in this incredible journey?
I mean, they've always supported me ever since I was a kid, just giving you that foundation and the tools and that encouragement throughout life. But it's really great connectivity on board the space station. We have email. As long as you have satellite coverage, you can call down. So I would call down quite often to talk to my family, to, you know, share in those experiences, or if I felt like I was feeling, you know, burnt out or overwhelmed. They really did a great job of giving you that right perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of being out there in space, looking down at, you know, our little blue marble orbiting 400 kilometers above us. I mean, what did you think about when you were looking down? Did you think about the enormity of space, the tiny, fragile little bubble that we lived in? Or
oh, absolutely. I mean, during the day, the Earth is quite bright. And as you look into the vacuum of space, you can't see any stars when you're in a day pass. And it is the blackest of black emptiness that I've ever seen. But you can't capture that. And as you look from the blackness of space down to the planet Earth, you can start to pick up these colors. And they're so dramatic and they're changing so quickly. And you can see this thin line that goes around our planet. And that's our atmosphere. And it's incredible to think that is the only thing that is keeping all humans on planet Earth alive and safe from the vacuum of space. And so you see this incredible planet and all its beauty and its majesty, but then you also have this incredible feeling of fragility. Oh my goodness. It's so important that we realize this and recognize this and take care of our planet. It's the only thing that we have. And so it gives you this amazing perspective and an appreciation for what we have on planet Earth. As you look down, you don't see any borders or boundaries. You don't see divisions of countries or states. You see humankind all coming together.
Mm-hmm. Many of our, you know, indigenous nations around Mother Earth or on Turtle Island say that the work that we do, the journeys that we're on, is something that we do for the next seven generations, mm-hmm. and that we are tomorrow's ancestors. How does it feel knowing that, you know, future generations from now will remember you and honor you and aspire to follow you into space?
It's really an honor. It is. And I, you know, it's an important responsibility. And it makes me feel very proud and excited to be able to hopefully inspire that young generation, to hopefully have, you know, a child look up and find something in me that they identify with, whether that be, you know, my love of soccer, whether that be my Native American heritage, whether that be, you know, my military service, and think, well, maybe that's something that I can do. That's something that I want to do. And so it's a wonderful honor. It makes me feel very, very excited.
Well, that is very exciting. And finally, Nicole, what message do you hope that you've carried from your journey into space and back and your future explorations that you're slated for? What gift do you want to leave the world?
Hopefully it's just the beginning, to be honest. There's so much going on in space exploration right now. You know, we talked about living life on board the International Space Station. We just had the Axiom 2 crew on board, which are civilian astronauts. And so you're seeing the commercialization of low Earth orbit, people that are able to visit space, sometimes for a suborbital flight, maybe 10 minutes, sometimes for perhaps 10 days. So it's not just government astronauts. It's now people making their way to space and space being accessible. And I think you're going to see the explosion of humans in low Earth orbit. But it also allows us now to focus on deep space exploration. So our missions to the moon and eventually to Mars. We just named the Artemis II crew, which are four astronauts, three Americans and one Canadian, that will go around the moon on the first test flight of our new spacecraft Orion. It's so exciting. This is the beginning of future missions. They're going to test out all these systems so that on Artemis III, we're going to send humans to the surface of the moon. But this time, not just to collect samples, this time to stay. We're going to have sustained human presence on the moon, habitats on the moon, people living on the moon. And really, this is a stepping stone for exploration to Mars. And so I think communicating that to the world, getting them inspired and excited, and hopefully they're excited to be a part of these journeys and these missions from countries all throughout the world, people of all different backgrounds, maybe as an astronaut, as an engineer, as a doctor, as a scientist, as a journalist, everybody can be involved. And I think I really think this is going to be the Artemis program will help to unite our planet. And I'm really excited to be a part of that.
Well, that is very exciting. I wish I could go, but sadly, I'm scared of heights.
It's okay. When you're in space, it's not that you're scared of heights, you're scared of gravity. You don't want to fall back down.
Yes,
you
right.
don't. You just, you're floating. So it's good. You'd be fine.
Excellent point, Nicole. Excellent point. Well, this has been a real pleasure speaking with you. I wish you all the best in your future explorations of the moon and Mars. And may I see statues of you in communities all across Turtle Island.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you today.
Nicole Mann is a member of the Wallachie of the Round Valley Indian Tribes and the first Indigenous woman in space. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild, Captain Space Nerd. Coming up, new tech for ancient stories, drones that bring our star lessons to a new generation of gazers.
We're going to show constellations in the sky, like the main stars of the Dipper. And we're going to talk about how the two stars in the Dipper, in the bowl of the Dipper, point to the North Star.
Kiwaitin means going home star in Cree. And this Canada Day, Star Knowledge Keeper Wilford Buck shares that story over the Winnipeg skyline. But first, some music about the stars. Indian City is a collaboration of Indigenous music makers. This one is called Star People and features Blue Rodeo's Jim Cuddy.
We're on the road, we're leaving now. Gonna find the place they call tomorrow. Tomorrow. It's the place we dreamed about. If we go, there ain't no doubt they'll follow. They'll follow. Suddenly we've come this far. I realize there's so much more to this life. This life. And I believe in you, and if you believe in me, we're there by daylight. Oh, take me to the stars. We can never go too far, too far. Take me to the stars. Let's find out who. Song with you in mind, we can pass the past with you in mind for right now. Right now, I had a dream of you and I. Seven sacred teachings show us why and show us how. Show us how. Hear the voice of Mother Earth, she's asking what she's really worth. She's
You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Jennifer Howes has spent a lifetime looking up at the stars. And for the last two decades, she's been looking up through a giant telescope. That telescope, at the University of Calgary's Rothney Astrophysical Observatory, is one of only a dozen giant telescopes in Canada. It helps Jennifer showcase and sometimes introduce the night sky to young visitors. Connecting youth to the constellations helps her teach them about the impacts of light pollution. Jennifer, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you, Rosanna.
Take me to your observatory, Jen. Can you describe the space that helps people connect with the stars?
We're in a wonderful place. We're located in the foothills of southern Alberta, and we're surrounded by the nations of the Blackfoot, Stoney Nakoda, and Tsuut'ina. And over the years, we've also been really fortunate to welcome young learners from the nations that get to come out to the observatory and learn a little bit more about the night sky and make some of their own personal connections to the universe while they're there.
Mm. And when I say giant telescope, how giant a telescope are we talking about here?
When we're talking about giants, the size of the telescope, what we're referring to is the diameter of the primary mirror. That's the size of a telescope. And so our telescope is 1.8 meters in diameter. And if you wanted to relate that, you can relate it to the Hubble Space Telescope, which is just slightly larger at 2.4 meters in diameter. And the bigger the mirror, the more light the telescope can collect, and that allows you to observe in greater detail.
Mm-hmm. How far away can you see with your giant telescope?
We're able to collect light from an object that was 9 billion light years away.
Wow, that's a long way. You had mentioned that you're surrounded by several Indigenous communities. Tell me about the kids that you're able to have visit the observatory where you work.
For example, we had some students come from Stoney Nakoda. I was talking to them about Indigenous skies and those land sky connections. And one of the students put up her hand and she said, "I have a story for you." A story that she had heard from an elder and that she found that that was important and significant enough to want to share it with the group. And that was so wonderful for me to hear that she was able to carry that with her. For me, that's very impactful. That tells me that there's a legacy there and kids are recognizing how important it is to make those connections.
Mm. How often do you meet kids at the observatory that have never seen the stars in this way?
I'm very sad to say that does happen. We are 20 minutes southwest of Calgary, and Calgary is a beast of light.
Mm-hmm.
And so much light in the sky. Unfortunately, there's been an upgrading of street lighting, which is much more, not only is it brighter LED lights, but it's also into the blue spectrum. So it's blasting light all night long. And so you'll get kids, say, more from some of the inner city areas who've never seen things like the Milky Way, for example. So I did have a group of grade sixes come one night from an inner city community, and they were just, as you can imagine, blown away by seeing the arc of the Milky Way in the sky, but also that I was able to just so easily point out planets that were visible that night and different constellations.
Mm, amazing. And when you say blown away, how did the kids react when they look up and they, you know, even without a telescope, see the sky all lit up like that, maybe sometimes for the first time in their life?
There's a certain awe moment, but it's like a realization that what they're seeing is the real thing. Children looking through an eyepiece, seeing Saturn, for example, the first time. And Saturn is exactly as you imagine it. It has those lovely rings, and that's what you see through the telescope. So there's been times where kids have actually checked, and they said, "Do you have a picture in front of the telescope?" So like, no, you're actually looking at the planet Saturn. So once there's that realization that they're seeing the real thing, that they're it's a real natural environment that they're in, then there is certainly an awe moment. It's quite inspiring for kids to experience that.
And in experiencing that, is that how you get them to understand what light pollution is?
Absolutely. If there's an appreciation for dark night skies and what that means, then you have a greater opportunity for people to realize that this is an issue. and that darkness is a natural thing. It's a natural phenomenon. Mm. That's how humans have evolved, to have the dark night skies and the lovely bright days. And we have built circadian rhythms that are in flow with that balance. So when we have too much artificial lighting, then what happens is we get a disruption in that balance, and it affects humans as well as animals, plants, insects.
Mm. And how does it impact people to be, you know, living in a city where they never see the stars and they never have that connection to the cosmos?
It's not about just, oh, it's just a terrible shame. There's studies that are coming out that we're starting to understand this a little bit more, that there is a physiological reaction, that there's higher incidence of cancer, for example, of people who work nights in bright lights. We live in a 24-hour society, and I appreciate that. And, you know, many astronomers appreciate that. But what we need to do is think about how we can live in that 24 hours with more balance. How can we be smarter about how we approach these ideas? And, you know, not overlighting, pointing light down, not up into the sky. And also, you know, it's okay to turn some lights off after midnight. Yeah. So that's all I want people to do, is just have a consideration about how they are living within that night and day cycle.
What's important, do you think, about that connection to the stars from an Indigenous worldview?
There's so much wonderful contextual learning about land and sky connection that's part of many Indigenous cultures. Navigation, spirituality, origin stories. Then there's survival knowledge, traditional knowledge. I'm just giving you just a small examples of many, many of these connections to the sky. And that's part of traditional ways of knowing. And it's so important to be able to be out in nature, to be able to see these things and to learn from them.
Yeah. So then why is it important, do you think, to involve and be aware of that, you know, Indigenous perspective and knowledge as we continue to explore, you know, further into space?
Indigenous knowledge is so important, has to do with understanding stewardship, living in balance. I've been doing this for a while, and people sometimes talk about traditional knowledge as if it's something of the past. Mm-hmm. And it's not. These perspectives are very important about how we live today, how we learn today, and how we are together in our communities, but also prescriptive in way we can live in the future in better ways. And so I love to be able to teach Indigenous students about science, because then they can take their perspectives and apply scientific knowledge and put that together and create something more positive. I think we need more diverse voices within the scientific field. We've heard from many people too much, and now we need to hear from everyone else in the scientific world, definitely.
Definitely. So then how do we get the greater population, the mainstream, to understand Indigenous perspective when it comes to things like light pollution and, you know, hindering our connection with the sky?
One of the things that I think is important is to get people just go out in their backyard, go out and have a look at the sky, see what you can find out, see what you can learn. You'll find out really quickly, it's a difficult science. And so imagine all of the thousands of years of knowledge people had from observing the sky on these, you know, say even in the plains of Western Canada. And all of those thousands of years of knowledge of understanding the regular cycles of planets moving across the sky, the sun, and during the solar year. And so that's one thing I think people learn right off the bat, is this is a difficult science. It would have been difficult for elders to convey to young people. So, of course, obviously, storytelling and sky lore was one of the tools that were used to be able to exchange that knowledge. I read the most wonderful thing recently, and it makes me smile when I think about it. Humans are the only things that get lost on the earth. All animals can find their way, but humans build a city, and then we get lost in the city that we built. And that's such a human thing. I think that when we start disrupting the night sky, disrupting those natural balances, that makes humans even more lost.
Mm. And as we move into the future and, you know, in exploring space and our place in it, how do you envision that relationship going as astronomy and science finally acknowledges and realizes that we actually do know kind of what we're talking about when it comes to mapping the universe?
Yeah, when I was a kid, this was not something that I could consider. But now the younger generation are going to be doing jobs. They're going to be doing work. They're going to be setting policies for things that we can't even imagine that have to do with near Earth space. I don't like to think about things in terms of like, oh, there's so much knowledge lost. I think we needed to change some of our colonial mindset and understand the value in the knowledge that is there. Understanding that there is these scientific approaches that were in indigenous based, and understand that sometimes there's a different way to look at things, and that's okay.
Yes, and also we have to acknowledge the knowledge that you carry and bring forward in terms of making sure our young people are connected still to the stars and understand that, you know, that we have been here for millennia, right? We have a place. We are star people, as they say.
Yes. Yes, we are. And so that being said, if people are living on reserve, they're living in the nation, they're in a rural area, think of the atmosphere, think of the sky above you as a natural resource in your area. If overlighting is an issue, you should be able to push back and say, that's not what we want. So once again, go out, look at the night sky, and just do one thing, one quick thing, is just close your eyes for a moment. And I want you to think about the Earth spinning on its axis, moving forward in space in its progression around the sun, and feel that motion. Feel that you're part of this much greater system. And you can open up your eyes and see all of the wonderful things in the sky, the Milky Way, the planets. And now we're going into the summer constellations this year. Specifically, I'm really encouraging people to go. August 13th will be the peak of the Perseids meteor shower. You definitely need to be away from city lights, but you also have to be away from the moon. And it just happens to be that the moon will be in close to a new moon phase. So it promises to be quite a spectacular show this year.
Well, thank you for that tip, Jennifer. I will definitely head out into the darkness on that date.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thank you.
Jennifer Howes is a member of the Métis Nation of Alberta and the education specialist at the Rothney Astrophysical Observatory at the University of Calgary, situated in the foothills of the Rockies. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, Indigenous connections to the constellations. Next, let's take a walk outside, shall we? We'll learn why Cree people believe we are star people. It's a quiet morning at the Forks, a spot in Winnipeg, Manitoba, where the Red and Assiniboine Rivers meet. Today, it's a popular tourist destination, but Indigenous people have been gathering here for millennia, for ceremony, community, and trade. In just a few days, these riverbanks will be bustling with people gathering to celebrate Canada Day. And while typically the day is capped off with fireworks, this year, people will be focused on a different kind of light, the incomparable and extraordinary light that comes from our galaxy. Well, sort of. The fireworks show is being replaced with a drone show featuring the teachings of Wilfred Buck. Wilfred is a star knowledge keeper from Apaskwayak Cree Nation, and he joins me here at the Forks for a very special conversation. Welcome to Unreserved again. Wilfred, welcome back. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Rosanna. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. So how would you describe the importance of this place, now known as the Forks, for Indigenous people?
Well, it's one of many gathering places and meeting places, and exchange of ideas, exchange of ceremony, culture, exchange of mixing of blood even. You know, one of the elders told me that it wasn't uncommon for our people to know 6 or 7 languages. And that says that they were meeting, and that says that they were taking the time to learn. Not only learn languages, but learn culture, learn ceremony, learn other perspectives.
Mm-hmm. So it's a really important gathering place, as you say, and certainly a good place for exchange of knowledge about our skies above. When you look up at the sky, what do you see?
Just the same as everybody else, a big mass of confusion up there. You look at the lights once you get away from all the city lights, all the artificial light, and view that sky. The first thing you see is just a jumble of confusion, a mass chaos up there, until you start studying it. And once you start studying it, then you start picking out, of course, your mind picks out the brightest stars. And then from there, you start recognizing some of the patterns. And then once you hear the stories, you start applying those stories. Is one of the words we use is chimwenak. Chimwenak means narratives. Trying to get away from that term story, because that term story connotates, in English, it connotates fairy tales, it connotates legends, mythologies, and a lot of these narratives that my people speak about when they talk about the stars are a lot more than mythologies or fairy tales.
Mm. What was the moment for you when you thought, I need to know about this, I need to know more about the indigenous perspective of stars?
Well, the exact moment was at 3:36 on...
Now you're just playing with me, Wilford.
Well, I had happened to be at a ceremony, a sweat lodge ceremony, with my teacher, the Piscawipi Samajape Sugama, the Moonbow Chief, and out in the Mistawasa, Saskatchewan, with one of our elders, Grandpa Joe DeKett. And we were doing a ceremony in the sweat lodge, and in the sweat lodge we were praying and they were singing, and I was in there and I was praying and I had my eyes closed, and I opened my eyes and I wasn't in the sweat lodge no longer. I was floating around in space and there were stars all around me, and I was just basically floating, and I closed my eyes really quick and opened them again, and it was there. It was still there. And then I started realizing, okay, there's something more to this than just what we're told.
Mm. Do you feel like that was the ancestors telling you that this is now your journey, your purpose?
Well, they're just I think they were just opening my eyes to showing me that there's other perspectives out there, and we have to be ready for, we have to keep our minds open to view those other perspectives.
Hmm. And since then, how many, I don't know if I can even ask that question, like how many teachings and how many different perspectives have you been able to learn since then?
Well, specifically constellations, we've come across probably about 36, 37 constellations from a Cree perspective. And this is specifically from an Inyo perspective. And that being said, there's Anishinaabe perspective, there's Siksika perspective, there's the Gota, Lakota, Nakota perspective, and they have their own skies, and they have their own constellations, and some of them are similar, but some of them are not, because obviously they're coming from a different different experience. And so we started with one, and we worked our way up to 36, 38 now, and at one point, one of the elders told me that we were outside the city of Saskatoon one cold September night at a place called Wanuskewin. And an elder by the name of Ken Goodwill from Standing Buffalo, we were looking at the sky, and he said, at one point, our people had a name for every visible star in this sky. Mm. And we were looking at that sky. And NASA tells us that on a clear night, with an uninterrupted view, we can see anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 stars. So the elder said every star had a connection, every star had a constellation, every star had a name, every star had a ceremony, every star had a song, every star had a teaching. And due to the historical trauma that happened to our people, we lost about 85% of that knowledge base. And so one of my aims is to try to get that knowledge back. And one of the things I was told when I started this journey with my one narrative about the Dipper, the elder told me that, don't worry. If you're meant to walk this road, and if you're meant to do this job, then people, places, things, and events will be put in your path, and you'll find your way. And that's been the case. People, places, events, and have been put in my way, and I've just walked along and picked these things up.
And in picking up those stories, and particularly the Cree stories about the constellations, what are you able to learn from that about our connection to the stars?
One of the things is that we are stars. The term we call those stars in Cree is Achagosak. And Achagosak comes from the root word Achak. And Achak can be translated as energy, light, spirit. We are energy. In our truest form, we are energy, we are light, we are spirit. And we come to this place, Watashki. We come here to visit. And when we come to visit, we take a physical form. And then when we finish our visit, we revert back to energy, light, spirit, and we continue our journey into multiple realities. We don't stop or keep coming back and trying to get it right, because there's multiple realities out there. We just keep going. And I had an opportunity to sit with the astrophysicist by the name of Dr. Kim Venn out of the University of Victoria. We went to ceremony together, and I invited her to her sweat lodge. And after the sweat lodge was over, she approached me, because she was very hesitant of attending the sweat lodge, because she said that she was very hesitant about organized religion, and that she didn't feel comfortable with that type of perspective. In the lodge, I was asked to talk about how we got here. Can we come to this place? So I spoke about energy and light, and I spoke about taking a physical form and then reverting back to energy once we're finished. Mm-hmm. And after the lodge was over, she approached me and she said, you know, this isn't what I was expecting. This is something I can relate to. What I heard was energy, and what I heard was light. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about is particle theory. And it makes so much sense, and I feel very comfortable with that. And I'd like to come back to a ceremony again. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. That's more than pretty cool. That's, you know, over and over again, as Indigenous people, we keep getting our, you know, our knowledge, our ancient knowledge, sort of confirmed by science. Did you mm-hmm. find that as well?
Oh, yes, all the time. There's a lot of examples. One of the amazing ones that I always talk about is being energy, being light. We come to this place and we visit, and we return back to energy. There's a place up in the sky we call Bagwangizik, the hole in the sky. And it's the constellation they call the Pleiades. And they say that's a very sacred place. They say that's where we come from. That's where we originate from. When they're talking about hole in the sky, they're talking about a spatial anomaly. They're talking about a portal, a wormhole, to another, an access point to another reality. And we come from that other reality to this reality. And we take a physical form, and then we revert back to energy and continue our journey once we're finished here. But that point there, they say when we sleep at night, our energy connects to that point in the sky when we dream. And that's why we dream for, because we're accessing that information. And we're bombarded with that information. We're given infinite possibility, glimpses of infinite possibility when we sleep. And sometimes we'll be sitting somewhere and say, hey, I've been here before, or hey, I've seen this before. I think the French call that deja vu. But we see that, and you say, yeah, you've seen that before, or yeah, you've been there before, because you dreamt about it. At some point, you were given that information. And so science calls this quantum theory. And yeah, that's what our people believe.
Yeah. I just think up fancier words for it. Pakwan Kise, quantum theory. Same. So now at this year's Canada Day celebrations, you're going to be telling the story of Kiwaitin, another one of our star stories. And that's the Cree word for North Star. Can you share some of that story with us right now?
Yes, well, and in the Cree language, as any Indigenous language, there are multiple identifiers to anything. In Indigenous astronomy, I found that studying the sky and looking at these patterns in the sky, there's different identifiers to them that they're given depending on what it is being talked about, what idea is being put forward, what teaching is being put forward. The Big Dipper themselves, we've come across about 8 different understandings about that group of stars. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the specific stars themselves, sometimes it's associated with other stars. Mm-hmm. And for the North Star, one of the terms we talk about when we look at that North Star is we call it Kiwaitin. Kiwaitin from the root word Kiwe, which means home. Kiwaitin Tagus, that's the going home star. And there's 2 understandings of that. One is that it's a going home star because it signifies where north is. And if you're traveling at night and if you know where north is, then you automatically should know where east and south and west is. Mm. That's one understanding. And another one is that's the going home star. When our journey is ended here, we go home to that place. Our energy goes to that place. It goes through the Milky Way. The River of Spirits, it's called, and it connects with the Northern Lights and the North Star. Mm. And then from there, we journey back up to Apagwengizik, the hole in the sky.
Wow.
So that's an identifier of one of the terms, Kiwet. And the other one is Ekagaatset. Ekagaatset means standing still. And, of course, that's the only star in the Northern Hemisphere sky that doesn't move at night, the North Star, the Polaris. It stays stationary.
And how are drones going to help you tell this story?
Well, hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully? Knock on wood?
We're going to show constellations in the sky, like the main stars of the Dipper. And we're going to talk about how the two stars in the Dipper, in the bowl of the Dipper, point to the North Star. And then we're going to highlight the North Star, and then we're going to show that the North Star is the end star of the constellation of the Little Dipper. And how that North Star stays stationary and all the other stars dance around it.
Cool. You're going to be like conducting this from the ground, or what is your role in it?
Well, I'm supposed to be doing the commentary as the drone show unfolds.
That's cool. Are you excited? I'd be excited.
Oh yeah.
As part of the show, we talked to an astrologist who looks up into the sky using a giant telescope, and she brings in particularly indigenous youth who might not have even seen the sky because they live in cities and they're affected by light pollution, and there's that disconnect is very, she argues, very real. Why do you think it's important to reconnect, particularly our young people, to the stars?
If they understand those patterns in the sky and they connect them to their culture, connect them to their identity, connect them to their ceremony, connect them to their language, there's a depth of knowledge involved there, and there's intellectual capacity involved there, and there's inclusion that's involved there. To acknowledge that the history of your people and the knowledge of your people is there and it's been held for thousands of years is very important for you to see that.
The other person that we spoke to was Nicole Mann, who is the first Indigenous woman to go to space. She just returned from space. It was very cool talking to her. What do you think that the role of Indigenous people is in future space exploration, leaving our planet and possibly, you know, venturing among the stars?
Well, there's lots of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I was had a conversation with a young astrophysicist and a scientist by the name of Alvin Harvey. He's studying in Harvard right now, and he's a Navajo Dene, and he was talking about that, our idea of colonizing space, and that there's some very touchy perspectives on that regarding colonizing space, because as colonized people, we understand that process, and we wouldn't like to be doing that anyplace else. So we have to be very aware of what these things are, and try to go about it as humbly as we can, and not imposing what is right and what is not right, and who is the best and who is not the best, and what we can claim and what we can't claim.
Mm-hmm.
But other than bringing that experience and exposing other perspectives, other than a narrow blinder point of view.
Wilford, thank you so much for your knowledge and your wisdom today.
All right, thank you.
Wilford Buck is a star knowledge keeper from Opaskwayak Cree Nation. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. Time to return to good old Mother Earth. This episode was produced by Rhiannon Johnson, Kim Kasher, Kenny Sharp, and Laura Bone Stubing. Shout out to NASA for all the cool space pics and videos. You can always find more on our website at cbc.ca/unreserved. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from the Turtle Island side of the galaxy, Planet Winnipeg, in Treaty 1 territory. Inaskanamit Nawi, Egusay.